is Yisro. Parshas Yisro, here's the pasuk that we're going to deal with today. And really, the truth is, we're dealing with a bunch of psukim. It's going to be the entire idea that goes through. Parak Yudchas Pasuk Yigimel, it says, it was the next day after Yom Kippur, according to Rashi, according to the Ramban, it's after the whole meal happened with Yisro and the rest of Moshe. But Yisro Moshe Lushpat is on. Moshe Rabbeinu sat down, he was judging the people. The people stood by Moshe Rabbeinu, from morning until evening. They were there the entire day, all day long. They were sitting there with Moshe Rabbeinu, getting judged by Moshe Rabbeinu, getting everything done. Now, here we go. Moshe Rabbeinu finally has time to sit down and deal with the issues that the people have brought up the entire time. Fine. He's been gone for 120 days. Let's say it's after Matzan Torah. We'll go with Rashi for right now. It's after Matzan Torah. It already happened. Right? It's 120 days later. The Egel is up. It already happened. There was a ton to deal with. He had been gone for 3 months. During those 3 months, 4 months altogether, during those 4 months, things had happened and people had lost money. People were dealing with one another. Things were not the easiest as well. The Chizkuni says they were dealing with Hilchos Tumah with the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav had to be decided what's going to be. There were monetary cases according to the Kliyaka that had to be decided. They wanted to know how to split up the riches from the Yamsuf. Did it go by person? Did it go by Shevet? How were they going to split up all the riches from the Yamsuf according to the Amloes? They had to learn Hilchos Derech Eretz, says the Gemara above Mitzian Daf Lamed, and the different dinin that had recently been given in Mara. They needed to know details, says the Moshe of Zakenim. Or just teaching them the Torah that he had learned while he's up there in Shemayim. Aside from that, everyone in the nation stood as close as they could to Moshe Rabbeinu. So we're talking as many as people as could fit in the area directly surrounding Moshe Rabbeinu. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu in the middle and the people just circling around row after row after row after row. You'd assume that Aaron, Yoshua, the Zakenim, Nadav and Abihu are dead. But, Nadav, Abihu, Elazar, Itamar, all of them around him in the first row, and then others behind and others behind and others behind. They're all standing as close as they could, running in, trying to hear everything that Moshe Rabbeinu said, every word, every nuance, every little message that he was going to do. And at the end of the day, when Moshe Rabbeinu would finish, everyone was exhausted. Moshe Rabbeinu, because he had spoken all day long and told over laws and was dealing with the people the entire day. And the people themselves, because they were standing up the entire time, trying to lean in to be able to hear. If anybody been to Meron on Lag BaOmer, you shouldn't have been there. You should have been there the day before, the day after. But if you were, you know what I'm talking about. There's no way to get in. At some point, you feel like you're flying. You're not standing on the ground anymore because you're just being held by stomachs of Hasidim. There's nothing else going on. You're just going from one place to the other. That's what it was like surrounding Moshe Rabbeinu. There was nothing that people were able to do. Yisro looked at him. He approached his son-in-law and he asked him, why did you feel that this is absolutely necessary? Why in the world did you think that this was something that was needed? Moshe answered, the nation wanted to hear what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to say. So he would teach them as much as he possibly could. That's what the idea was. He turned to them, he said, Yisro said to him, why are you doing what you're doing? And Moshe Rabbeinu answered and said, I'm doing everything I could. Yisro was worried about Moshe Rabbeinu, his son-in-law's health. He's worried about his stamina. And not only his, the health and the stamina of the entire nation. There's no way that the people could keep this up of standing by Moshe Rabbeinu all day long, trying to strain to hear a couple words. If you've ever been to that type of a shir klali, and you're standing on the outside, eventually people just say like, ah, forget it, I barely hear anything anyway. What's the difference? Why should I stand on the outside? I'm not hearing anything. So 50 people will hear it, 100 people will hear it, maybe even 1,000 people will be able to stand by Moshe Rabbeinu. But there's no way you can have all 600,000 people standing there and going around. So Yisro sat there and said, I'm going to suggest something. I want a new cast of judges, a system that will be there. Teach them how to do things conceptually, and then here you should only hear the most pressing cases. That opens up your time. Now you'll be able to teach Torah to the people the way you wanted to. You'll be able to learn the way you're supposed to do. This is the idea of Yisro telling them, make judges for the nation itself. Now our only problem is we have to figure out what really was behind this idea. What fool, and I don't mean to say this way because obviously it's Moshe Rabbeinu, what fool couldn't have figured this out on his own? What kind of a person is looking at that and saying like, oh, judges, great call. It's not like, remember, Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach includes Dinin. Dinin means to set up a court system. It's obvious that you need something like that. Why would Moshe Rabbeinu have thought otherwise, that you don't need judges, you don't need anything? How could he have possibly thought that he was going to be good enough to teach the entire nation? And why was it Yisro over anybody else who got up and he said, here's what you got to do, this is what you have to do over here. So the Ramban, first we're going to go with Ramban, we're going to give a bunch of answers to this question, but we're really going to try to figure out, just push up shot, what was the psychology of the nation at the time? The Ramban says that Moshe's real job was to be the Navi that anyone could go to for their troubles. That's what he thought. By Shmuel HaNavi, when Shaul HaMelech had lost his donkeys and had no idea where the donkeys were and was going looking around for them, this is how Shaul HaMelech ended up becoming king. When Shaul HaMelech was going around trying to find from one place to the other, Shmuel HaNavi stood there. Shmuel HaNavi got up. Shaul HaMelech, got up and said, let's go to Shmuel HaNavi. Let's go ask him these questions. See, by the Nevi'im, that's what the Navi is there for. He asks all the questions that you could possibly have. He's the one that answers everything. He assumed that that's why they were coming to him. They came to him to daven for their sick, which makes sense. They came to him to help them when things went bad, you know, marital problems, anything that's there, they would go to Moshe Rabbeinu for, and to judge cases when cases came up, that's what they were going for. Okay, Yisro's suggestion was simple. Get rid of the court cases. Allow these judges to be there for the court cases, because if you're the one there teaching them Torah and giving them court cases and everything else, you'll be inundated with cases. The people are going to be lined up and they're going to forget about it. They're going to be so annoyed. They're going to be like, you know what? If I have to wait 7 hours to hear my case to be heard in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm not going to do it. I was getting annoyed last week standing in line for 10 minutes. Why 10 minutes? Because Noki's in a wheelchair. So I got into every single ride. Absolutely. First, all they do is they open up the line. They're just like, go ahead. So I just took them all the way in. I'm just telling you, if you ever go to Disney World and you don't have a wheelchair, I don't know what you're doing. But I got in perfectly, and I was getting annoyed when I got to the very end that I had to wait like 3.5 minutes for them to call a person to be able to help me with my kid that's in a wheelchair. I was sitting there like that. Can you imagine waiting 7-8 hours for your court case to be heard because there's only one judge that's there? And even then, you might not get heard that day. You might not have anything happen. Can you imagine being that guy in line, and then all of a sudden Moshe's like, all right, guys, I got to go to sleep. It's been 13 hours in a row. And you're just like, oh, no, you ain't. You ain't doing that. You can't do that. Says the Ramban, it's obvious that this is not going to work. And he said, you're going to become upset. They're going to become upset enough to take the loss rather than go to Beis Din, and they're going to blame you. They're going to say to themselves, you know why I couldn't win the court case? Because Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't find the time for me. They're going to be so angry at you, not at anybody else, at you. Now this won't be a problem. Now you'll have judges taking care of those cases. You'll be able to teach the people. Anybody that needs their court cases done, they'll go to the courts. You'll be able to do everything else. That's the Ramban. That's his understanding of the sukkah, the entire understanding of the psukim, and that's that. The Shach al HaTorah, this is not, again, the Talmud of the Arizal, said that Yisro saw that he was judging them in a very strange fashion. He was doing it quicker than he'd ever seen a judge work before. He took one look at the two litigants, the people that were in front of him, and he said, you're guilty, you're innocent, out. Second guy's come up, you're guilty, you're innocent, get out. He wasn't hearing their claims. Most of it was judging them based on the Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah that he had, understanding what was there in front of him and just telling them what was going to be in each case, telling them what was going to be. Everything was moving so quickly. In other words, it was taking a long time because there were a lot of court cases to deal with. But they were moving one after the other, and Yisro could not understand what was going on. Yisro was afraid, and rightly so. Just think about it from your perspective. You always think you're right. When somebody doesn't even take the time to hear your claim and just says, this is what God says, he's right, you're wrong, you're going to come out from that court case saying, I just got gypped. That's not God's word. That's Moshe Rabbeinu not caring enough to hear my entire court case. He's sitting there. All the people are sitting there saying, he just doesn't care. He's not listening to us. Said Yisro, you can't allow it to continue this way. And it makes so much sense if you keep judging this way. Number one, this will not be able to last. Because what happens when you die and the next person comes up and he can't do what you're doing? Number two, people are going to be so angry at you. They're going to sit there. They're not going to want to bring their court case to you because they don't trust you. And that's all it is. One person loses, then all of a sudden they put the blame entirely on you. That's not what you want. You don't want that to happen. Let the judges take that, and you just sit there and teach. That was the second idea, says the Shach. The Ksav Sofer says something else. Yisro saw that the people were getting their cases taken care of, the people were hearing their court cases, and they weren't leaving. Because I'm giving you an example. When I was in yeshiva, and I was in the Mir Yeshiva, Rav Asher Arieli was my Rebbe, and we used to learn, my last year there, I was in Beis Yeshaya, which had just opened up. It's the new Beis, well, not new anymore, but a newer base medrash across the little streetway from the regular base medrash there. I remember in morning seder, we had kashas that we wanted to ask our Rebbe. Now the fact is, when you go to a place like the Mir, and you're around all these people, there were 400 people in the shir at the time, most of the people there were as good as Magidei Shirim in any shir in the world. These people were Talmidei Chachamim beyond Talmidei Chachamim. So when we had a shayla, you could really just ask the guy next to you, and he probably knew Shas Bal Peh, rather than have to go to the Rebbe. But there were times we wanted to go to Rav Asher, and we wanted to sit there, and we wanted to ask him a question, you know, to be able to say, like, okay, we're going to ask our Rebbe, we're going to hear what the Rebbe has to say about the matter. But the line was out the door. When Rav Asher would sit down, there'd be 7, 8, 9 people just surrounding him completely, and then you'd have to get in line, and maybe go in. But the problem was that nobody would ever leave. A guy would ask a question, and then after he finished his question and he got the answer, then everybody would stay to hear the next person's question. So they would hear. So the first guy would ask a question, the second guy would ask a question, third guy would ask a question, fourth guy would ask a question, and there was no room to move in. And they all stayed. And then once it went to round robin, first guy thought of another question. So he came up with another one. There was no way in. All you could do is literally pull them by the tzitzis strings out from the circle and say, like, do you mind if I get in there? Can I have this dance? And jump inside and try to say, like, all right, I'm going to try to get in there. Says the Ksav Sofer, Yisro was seeing that nobody was leaving and couldn't understand it. Why wouldn't they leave afterward? And Moshe Rabbeinu taught him the concept of learning Torah. Think about it. Yisro knew about judging. He had never heard of the concept of learning Torah before. What does it mean? You want to know someone else's case. What does that mean? Why are you gaining anything? It didn't happen to you. What's the point? And Moshe Rabbeinu told him, there's a concept of becoming smarter. There's a concept of working on yourself and becoming greater and greater. Yisro was shocked by that. He couldn't believe it. But he said that it makes more sense for you to teach the Torah and for someone else to judge. Why should you have halacha lamaisa in front of you? You should teach them what to do before they come to court. You should be the teacher before anything happens. And they should only come to you if they can't get answered by anybody else. But if you teach them before, and that'll help everybody. Everything will be good, since the Ksav's over. And the Malvim says, it makes so much sense according to the Malvim. They didn't know any pertinent laws yet. Parshas Mishpatim had not been written, had not been told over to the people yet. If that was so, then Moshe Rabbeinu, Yisro assumed that Moshe Rabbeinu was judging everything out of his own logic. He was logically concluding what you should say in any situation. And that's what he was doing. Said Yisro, if you're doing it out of logic, other judges can do it out of logic. What's the difference between your logic and everybody else's? You could do it just as good as anybody else. And then he saw the people. It says in the Pasuk, there were omdim. An omed, says the Malvim, means to stand attentively and to hear everything correctly. The people were that way. But Yisro didn't see that. Yisro wasn't in the middle by the people that were standing attentively listening to every word of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yisro was on the outskirts, looking at the people on the outside who were getting sick and tired of hearing every other word of Moshe Rabbeinu, not being able to even see their Rebbe, not being able to see the teacher, even though they were standing up on chairs and looking down, not being able to see anything. They were nitzavim, feeling like they were forced to be there and not wanting to be there at the same time, waiting for the first opportunity to be able to leave. When he saw them nitzavim, and he said it to Moshe Rabbeinu, why are you making the people nitzavim? He saw the people on the outside leaving. He told Moshe Rabbeinu, your greatest fear is here. You're not affecting the people. You're allowing people to move out, and you're not doing it in the right way. You have to teach them in a different fashion. You have to get a hold of people in a different fashion and make it happen in that way. The Chafetz Chaim says, Mamish, that it was dealing with things that were going to be in the future. But here's the issue. There's a concept called Siyata Dishmaya. And in many cases, even though it seems the judge did not see the case correctly, a judge will have Siyata Dishmaya on the spot to be able to say the right psak for that moment in time. Giving you an example, when a referee sees a play, there is no Siyata Dishmaya there. In fact, I'm pretty sure the greatest issue of Hester Punim is during football games. There is 100% idols. That is 100% idol worship. And I love it. But nonetheless, we all agree. We all have to agree. It is 100% Avodah Zarah. If you would define what Avodah Zarah would be, it's okay. You can disagree on that. But if we would define it, I think football would be 100%. It's still unbelievable. Regardless, the Chafetz Chaim says that judges, the referees, don't have that Siyata Dishmaya. So they very easily could see a wrong call, and it's the wrong call. Says the Chafetz Chaim, judges are given a little bit of extra Siyata Dishmaya when there's three of them there. The Shechina comes down with them and allows them to say something that even though they're wrong, and you got to be careful with that because when it comes to Torah, everything is right in a way, but even though they passed in incorrectly for that case, that may be what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted in the first place. Chofetz Chaim says, we have no idea what goes into the ultimate judgment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if the judges are doing it l'shem shamayim, not if they're doing it for bribes, or for their own sake, or for their own l'shem themselves, then maybe there's no siyata d'shamayim. But if a judge is doing it correctly, thinking they're trying to help other yidin, and they're there and they've studied Torah all their lives, then there's an extra little bit of siyata d'shamayim that even when they're wrong, they're right. There's a difference between a regular judge doing something and these judges, these dayanim over here. Moshe Rabbeinu was telling them the psak that they needed to know for those cases, for the cases that were there in front of them. But he was telling them hypothetical cases, says the Chofetz Chaim. He wasn't actually judging anyone. He's telling people what would be if this comes up in the future. And on that, that's what Yisro said, that's not how judging should work. I'm just giving you this example. You can't take, and the Igros Moshe, what Moshe says this in the very beginning in his introduction, you can't take my Igros and apply it to any court case without thinking it through completely. Because every court case is different. Even though I might have paskin like Reuven over Shimon in this case, your case may not be the exact same case. It might seem like the same case, but there might be a chiluk. So you can't use my Igros Moshe to paskin a shaila in a specific instance, even if it seems similar, unless you could be medama it together and show how each one of them connects with one another. You can't do it, you can't just make it up, because obviously each case is 100% different. Said Rav Moshe, you have to be careful with how you use my psukim in every situation, because I don't want it to just be used and say, this is what Rav Moshe held. I'm answering this for that guy. Some say that that's the reason why chelek ches and chelek tes of the Igros Moshe should never have been printed. Chelek tes was written, are both put out by great Gedolim, Chelek Ches and Chelek Tes. So we're Gedolim that put it out. But some say they never should have been. If Rav Moshe didn't want those tshuvas printed up, he didn't want them printed up.
Maybe he never got around to it.
I'm sorry, that's true, and that's what they hold. But there may be a reason. The other side is that maybe he didn't want them printed up for a reason. He was writing for one specific person. For that specific person who wrote, for that specific rabbi who was asking him the question, maybe he didn't want that to be public knowledge. And that's the shiloh when you get into stuff like that. Says the Chofetz Chaim that Yisro said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you want to teach some cases, I understand it. But don't tell them that this is the psak for the future. They won't understand that, and they won't realize that every case has its own bit of siyata d'shamayim. It's already over there. You can't compare all cases to one another. Or HaChaim HaKadosh says Yisro thought Moshe Rabbeinu was forcing them to come to him and not go to anyone else. Or HaChaim says it seemed like Moshe Rabbeinu was telling them, you better not go to anybody else, everybody come to me, and not allowing them to go anywhere else. When Moshe Rabbeinu said to them, that's not what I'm doing. The reason why they're coming to me is because I have a direct line above. I can have Ruach HaKadosh and I speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so they want to be with me for that real reason. I know that this situation can't last, but for right now, I want people to be with me so that they hear the direct line from above. Said Yisro, you understand, it's not going to last at all. It's not even going to last until tomorrow. Tomorrow, nobody's going to show up, and that's why he told them to switch it around a little bit. Fine. There's a couple others over here. There's the Rav Chaim Kanievsky that said that Hashem told him all the mitzvot. It was his responsibility to say it over the people. He felt that he could only do it because he's the one that was given it to tell over to the people themselves. On that, we learn a tremendous lesson. And this is a lesson that we should know for life. Okay, it goes like this. The idea of Torah, and throughout the entire Torah, there's a lesson being learned. Always ask questions first, and then do it afterward. Don't do it and then ask questions later. I'll give an example, okay? Your wife just baked a really, really nice cake. It's sitting on the kitchen counter. And you say, I'm sure my wife would be perfectly fine with me having a massive slice of cake, right? So you take a little slice, and then you take the rest, obviously, and you eat it, and you tell your wife afterward, that cake was delicious, I had a big slice. Okay? Bad idea. Why is that a bad idea? Because she baked it for her bake club. And as much as they don't deserve it as much as you do, that doesn't matter. Because that's going to cause anger and welcome to the couch. Okay? Which means that you ask before you get to such a situation. Go up to your wife and you say to her, is it okay if I have a slice of cake? Then, even if she says no, I don't want to say whether you should or not, but you at least ask, and you get it down, so at least you know, this is what my wife, no, you cannot have it. I made this specifically for the Rosh Hashiva. Rosh Hashiva certainly would want me to have a piece. Right? But throughout the Torah, you have this concept. If only Chava and Adam would have said to Hashem, hey, is this snake right? That's all they had to do. It's not like HaKadosh Baruch Hu was around. Adam and Chava are sitting there talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All they had to do is say, the snake is a good time. Is he right? Is this a good idea? God, should I eat this? There would have been no problems. Hashem would have said, no, kill the snake. And everything would have been fine. There would have been no issues. Throughout the whole Torah that applies, ask questions first and then figure it out later. Just ask the question before he gets anything else. That's the idea. What he was trying to say and what the Mayana Shel Torah is saying is, Yisro's question was, why wouldn't you make sure there's a situation where you can ask all the questions beforehand, before court cases come? He couldn't believe there's a nation that had so many questions when there weren't so many issues. You had mun, you had clouds, you had your own homes, you have water. What else could you need while you're sitting in the midbar? Privacy, I guess. But what else could you possibly need when you're sitting around here? Ask first and come out afterward. And then comes the Kedushas Levi, the end of this part of the idea, was saying Yisro bothered, he asked why Yisro bothered asking Moshe Rabbeinu anything. He should have simply told him that he was going to wear himself out. Why ask him? In other words, right over here, Yisro said, what are you doing? Moshe said, I'm judging the people and I'm speaking to them about God and teaching them the Torah. And Yisro said to him, not a good idea, you're going to wear yourself out. Says Kedushas Levi, skip the question. You know what the answer is. You clearly know what he's doing over here. Just say you're going to wear yourself out. That's the Kedushas Levi's question. His answer is that when a tzaddik speaks to people beneath his level, then what he's doing is he's raising their level up to his, but at the same time he's lowering himself to speak to them. Every tzaddik that speaks to the people, you have a Rav Chaim Kanievsky that gets up and speaks to the people, you have a big Rosh Hashiva that gets on to speak to people, when he says over the Torah that he wants to say, he's not saying it on his level. He's saying it over on the level of the people that he's speaking to. That's what a tzaddik is able to do, and not everybody is able to do that. That's not a great thing. Or that a regular person is telling it over to people who are on their level. So he's just saying it as he would to himself. He's saying it over. A tzaddik has to lower himself a little bit. Yisro was saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to be very careful. Granted, you have the ability to pull the people up, but you also have a tremendous ability to pull yourself down. And we're not talking about a normal person here. You're a guy who has to deal with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You can't deal with the people directly. You can't deal with court cases directly. If you get involved with two litigants, and the two litigants get into a fight, and they start cursing each other out, you're going to be privy to that. You're going to hear those curse words, and those curse words are going to affect you subconsciously. Subliminally, it's going to go into you. You have just knocked yourself down from that level to that level.
By definition, Zion, that's his job, is to relate to the people.
Correct.
You can't be on a different plane. You can't judge people.
Correct. The only person who is not like that is Moshe Rabbeinu. The same way that Moshe Rabbeinu was exhorted not to go back to his wife. Same way that Moshe Rabbeinu was told to sacrifice his life for the people. He was literally an Yisro Elokim, like no one else that we've ever had. Yisro recognized that, and he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you can't be like everybody else. You need other people judging the cases, and you only take the top, and you sit there teaching the people that want to sit at your feet, the Yoshuas, and the Nadav and Abihus, and the Elazar and Itamar. You sit there and do that. He looked at them and he saw that the people weren't growing the way they should have been. They're not. They're just not being the people that they should have been. Said Yisro to Moshe Rabbeinu, if they're not growing, that means you're going down. And that's the most dangerous thing that could happen to Klal Yisrael right now. Says the Kedushas Levi, that was the biggest worry that they had to deal with. It's a very interesting call. I never really thought of it this way, but it is interesting. There are... I've never really had that Hasidic Rebbe, you know, give him a little the patek to be able to give to him so that he can daven for you, etc. I've dealt with, you know, the Mekubalim, but I've never known whether they were real Mekubalim or just a guy who knows Kabbalah. I have absolutely no idea if it's real or not. I just don't know. But I've never really dealt with that. It's an interesting call to be able to sit there and think to yourself, why is the Mekubal doing what he's doing? Is he mamish doing it l'shin shamayim for Klal Yisrael to raise the level of the people that are coming to see him? Or is he doing it just to make a little bit of money? It's a shiloh. If he's doing it for money, then you can imagine he's being brought down by the people that he's seeing. And if not, maybe it's something different. I've always thought that way, but the Kedushas lady is saying it outright. That's what Yisro was telling Moshe Rabbeinu, that he's worried about the Kedusha of Moshe Rabbeinu goes through. Rabbi Victor Miller has an entire way of looking at this episode, which is totally different from everything else, which I want to go through just to understand what it is. What people overlook when they run through these Sfarim is that these people were very different from any other time. You want to think this way, okay? Yes, they got the money. Yeah, they got water. Yeah, they had the Anani HaKavod. I agree. This was an awesome existence where you didn't have anything to do, you were given everything in the world. On the other hand, the mun was not filling. You were always hungry. It just gave you enough nutrients that you were able to live and you had no issues whatsoever. But it did not mean that your hunger was abated. That's number one. The water, okay, it's possible the water did quench their thirst. I don't know about that. They don't talk about that. But the mun was different. It was a spiritual food, not a physical food. The homes that they were in the Anani HaKavod was not kishmak. I want you to think of this way. Can you imagine leaving your homes in Mitzrayim? And I realize they were slaves, but do remember that some of them were wealthy and some of them owned sheep and cattle. They brought their animals out from Mitzrayim. We're not talking about where everybody was poor. People leaving their homes, real homes, when they lived in Egypt, and living in tents in the desert. I mentioned before, no privacy. Consider this. You're in one big tent, and you're sitting there with all of your kids, possibly three or four generations in the same exact tent. There is no one that gets real separation. And even when you walk outside, there's a bunch of tents right around you. Now granted, Bilam saw that the doors were not facing one another. But that already tells you something. If the doors were facing each other, they'd be able to see what everybody else was doing. That means if you're walking in the street, whatever street they had in the middle of the desert, you could look into anybody's tent and see what's going on inside there. There was no privacy. None. Says Rabbi Victor Miller, never do you hear a complaint about that from any of Bnei Yisrael. Never did Bnei Yisrael say to Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't have any privacy. I have no time for myself. And if they were giving birth to kids, yeah.
They had to figure out something because they were having children.
Agreed. Meaning, obviously, there must have been privacy at night. But there were no private tents that they didn't have. That's the Pella that comes out. Rabbi Victor Miller is pointing out, yes, they have to be quiet, they have to be silent. And they were together with each other in front of their family while everybody else was there.
How do we know that?
It's a pet. Oh, they had kids. Even so, tents are very thin and flimsy. So we're dealing with, it's just, even if they had their own private tents, one for the father and the mother, and one for the kids, right, and one for the kids, others that went around when everybody got married, etc., you're still dealing with very little privacy, no way to lock yourself up. We're not dealing with even tents that we have nowadays. So, Victor Miller, we're dealing with something which is very, very strange. It was a big change. They had no jobs. They had no fields to take care of. The animals were being tended by the Arab Rav, which meant the people had nothing to do. By definition, when people have nothing to do, especially guys, people get into mischief. People do dumb things. People will do dumb things. That's what people do. But never did the people not take advantage of the situation. They sat there and they learned. They did something which is completely different. Says Rabbi DeMiller, this was a 40-year training period, getting them ready for a life when they would work, how they had to prepare themselves for it. It really was the first idea of full nationwide kolel. Now granted, they were taken care of. They had everything they needed. But it's the first example, and possibly the greatest example, where everyone worked for God. Nobody did anything else, and that's that. The family being completely supported, not luxuriously, right? But you're still being completely supported in such a way. That's why this suggestion of Yisro comes into such a hard thing. Now, we've been dealing with judging and dealing with where Yisro said you can't do it, anything like that. Rabbi Victor Miller takes it a totally different direction. Can you imagine? In a world where you have no privacy, Yisro said, I want you to make judges. Here's what I want. Judges of tens, judges of 50, judges of hundreds, judges of thousands. Now, if you do the math correctly, for 600,000, judges of thousands is going to be 600. Judges of 100 is going to be 6,000. Judges of 10 is going to be 60,000. Judges of 50 is 12,000. Okay, so if I did my math correctly, that is altogether 60,000 plus 12,000 plus 6,000, right, plus 600. It's altogether 78,600 judges. Okay, 78,600 judges. My number is correct. The Ramban says there were altogether 78,600 judges. You know what that's like? Where a guy is in charge of every 10 people, and that guy has to answer to somebody who's in charge of every 5 of those guys, and that guy has to answer to 2 of those 50s, and that guy has to answer for every 10 of those guys. You know what it's like when a guy comes up to you constantly saying, Moshe Rabbeinu wants to know if everything's okay in your tent. Not only was there no privacy, there was constant surveillance where there were people watching over. You had a mashkiach on every 10 people. Every 9 people, there was a 10th person in charge.
What you're describing doesn't sound like a utopia in the desert. It sounds like it was awful.
It sounds like 1984. It sounds like George Orwellian, the idea of Big Brother taking care of you at all times.
Well, it's like everyone's fired.
And now think for a second. At the end of the day, nobody complained about that. The constant surveillance, we don't have it in the Torah. Now you're right, could be that it's outside of the Torah realm. But it is something that, even though B'nai Yisrael were complaining about many, many other things, they never complained about the most obvious thing of all. I'm being bothered by people all the time.
Well, why are we
and I can't deal with that.
That way, instead of saying that, sorry, Atzarot, which, I mean, the fact that you would even need a judge for every 10 people is assuming that there's an extremely litigious society, like way more than any other society you could imagine. But
it could be. Do you think those people would handle the judge as well?
No, I would.
So you'd think there'd be rebellion?
Well, I would think that that was a way of passing down, you know,
the word from Moshe Rabbeinu to everybody else. Do you think everybody would be able to accept it that way? And yet the rebelliousness
that's
of that...
That's the efficient way to do it.
I understand. But rebellion-wise, that's the easiest way to start a rebel. That's the easiest way to start any rebellion. Now, granted, we do have Korach. But that wasn't the issue. Korach never complained about this. Korach and Dustin and Abiram never complained about this. I just to consider this, to think about it, let it stew in your mind. That is crazy. I don't know if I would be able to handle that. And all the people had it in that way. Meaning, this is going to be a fundamental change. The fact that the Torah was being given to them and they have to change things around. They needed people to be in charge of every 9, every 90, etc., taking care of all the people that were around there. And it was extremely hard to train the people in this way. And that's why 40 years was a perfect amount of time to be able to do it. Yisro said, this situation cannot exist where you don't have such surveillance. Yisro knew that allowing Moshe Rabbeinu to be the only person telling it over to the people and allowing to be, he's the only policeman, so to speak, which is what it was, is not going to work. You need people getting around teachers and leaders, helping them along the way to the point where they would like them. They voted in their 78,600 judges. They voted in who they thought should be in charge of each other. And that was the only way for such a thing to be able to work. Even then, I can't believe it existed. It didn't work, but it did. Yes, Ari, what were you going to say?
Oh, you're still getting 600 different words. You know?
Opinions from different people going through. Now, you are playing a big game of telephone. There's no question there would have been some things that were messed up. I agree with that in certain ways. That's going to be around there. But nonetheless, they have to do that because of the other alternative over here. Another line by reverse is such a brilliant line. So why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu think of this? Why wasn't this obvious to Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu could not be an innovator. Why couldn't he be an innovator? He was Torah Shebichtav. If he makes up something, everybody thinks it's from God. He couldn't make a decision that wasn't given to him by God. It had to be said over by somebody else, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was masking to it. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have told it over to Moshe Rabbeinu, but he wanted to be Mezakeh Yisro. And why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say it, of course Moshe Rabbeinu thought of it. But Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed to make a decision on his own to be able to say, here's what we're going to do in order to tell it over to the people. He did exactly what he had to do in just that. Okay, we've got a lot of stuff over here. The Chassam Sofer says that Yisro did this L'shem Shamayim. He was a tremendous tzaddik. He felt that it was going to be the best thing. He knew that it wasn't going to work. He even said that my children should not be part of the Sanhedrin of these judges. It should be everybody else except for people like me. Everybody among B'nai Yisrael should be involved. But Yalkut Reuveni says something crazy. Yalkut Reuveni says, this is the work of the Satan. Yisrael was evil. Deep down inside, he had the nitzutz, the spark from Cain. And he wanted to cause kinna, jealousy, and sinna, hatred, throughout all of Klal Yisrael. Even though he didn't realize it, and he thought he meant it in the best way. The Satan was involved the whole time, says the Yalkut Reuveni. And when Yisro suggested the judges, and as we said, 78,600 people were chosen, some of them didn't vote for those people. When those people got up there, you can imagine some of Klal Yisrael looking at them like, I hate that guy. That guy got chosen? I'm so much better than him. I don't want that guy to be my judge. And people started hating each other. There was Achdus at Har Sinai. After they left Har Sinai and Yisro came and suggested about the judges, there has never been Achdus since. That was what Yisro brought into Klal Yisrael, says the Yalkut Reuveni. He destroyed them. He literally destroyed them. And when Moshe Rabbeinu figured it out in Parshas Baal Oscha, says the Rechaim HaKadosh, he kicked them out. Yisroel left and was gone forever. He realized that Yisroel's suggestion, although so seemingly so good, caused that hatred in Kina and Kla Yisroel, and was so worried, such a shot from the Al-Gurbini. What's up, Ellie? So yes and no. He must have realized the thought that Yisrael was strong enough to get over it because of the Vayicha Neged Ahor. They were tremendous people. I'm sorry?
Moshe
Rabbeinu agreed, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was masking. But nonetheless, deep down inside is the work of the Satan. The same way that Moshe Rabbeinu could choose to keep the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav were part of Klal Yisrael. They could be part of Klal Yisrael even though they were evil. The same way that Moshe Rabbeinu could choose to save Dothan and Aviram, and they were part of Klal Yisrael, so too the same type of idea. I'm sorry?
But their actions were approved by Moshe and Hashem.
But Moshe Rabbeinu's action in saving Dothan and Aviram, where he said to, according to the Medrash, called out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, should I save these two children? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, yes, you can save them, and pulled them out of the river. Right? That was HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Moshe, you can save them. There was an action by Moshe Rabbeinu that led to Dothan and Aviram being the people that they were. Without that, if Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have done that, right, it wouldn't have happened. So in a way, Hashem is still maskin to human nature to agree to do something even though it's not the best thing for you. That's the concept, says the Al Kuruvani. It's a crazy, crazy concept. The Gra says something very, very similar, a lost opportunity, but that's that.
Sometimes then, how would they be going to organize themselves because...
Again, it's deep down from the Satan. Not that it was the Satan only, and it was only evil, right? And there was nothing good to it. There were good aspects to this idea, but the Satan was behind it, knowing that there would be sin and kinah involved deep down inside. And Bnei Yisrael had to get over it. They couldn't get over it. They didn't get over it, and unfortunately, it didn't work. Yeah. What that way is, I don't know. I don't think anybody has ever been able to figure out. But there could have been a way for it to work. Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu choosing them instead of the people themselves. Ellie, what's up?
I mean, you touch on... Why are you trying to give a mitzvah to us? That was Moshe's advice, and the reason behind it was like, okay, if you don't say yes, it's going to look bad.
Mm-hmm.
This is like 100% what you're saying, is it's not going to work out.
No, not that 100%. That's what I was trying to point that out. It's not that 100% it's going to work out.
It's not going to be okay.
Yeah, it's not that 100% it's not going to work out. It's just, it could and it might not. It depends on how the people take it. It depends on how the people work with each other. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. But that's not the Shiloh. The Shiloh is not that. It's a human, people have to be put in positions to succeed. And even if they fail, so what? They were put in a position to succeed. It could have worked out. We're going to do two more points over here. Rav Avadya Yosef. There's a new thing that was put out, not by him, but by his Talmidim, based on his writings. They say over here, based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Aleph, if anybody knows the story of Unkelos, where Unkelos was sent by the Emperor of Rome, people to be able to bring them back to Rome, and Unkelos kept being Megayer them. Well, that he speaks about it and says, the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to talk to the people is because he knew the power of a tzaddik speech is so much. To hear a tzaddik say certain things are there. And I've done this. I've sat in on rabbi speeches, rabbis with bigger rabbis, and they make the corniest joke I've ever heard before in my life. And people are cracking up. Absolutely cracking up. And why? Because you don't expect that from that rabbi. You don't expect it from it. You hear the rabbi say such simple words, things that you would have said, like, okay, he didn't say any big chidushim. And yet people come out from it and they feel affected by such a speech. It doesn't happen every time, but there are certain rabbis that have that ability. They're able to give something over that's so pashut, and it's coming from the words of the rabbi. They all love it. It's all there. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that his words being spoken to the people as opposed to anybody else's would be so much more effective. So he spoke to the people. He's the one that did everything, and that's that.
Yeah,
when the Chofetz Chaim... I'm sorry.
That
was the problem. The Chofetz Chaim, when he got older, so Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, he was one of his great Talmidim, him and the Panovich Rav, but Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Rabbi Chaim was a great entity. He used to sit there for hours on end just listening to the Chofetz Chaim Darshan and Chumash. Forget about like a big shear, like a very deep shear, anything like that. They would just listen to him Darshan and Chumash. That's all it was. To be able to sit there and listen, what did the Chofetz Chaim say? Because they knew the Chofetz Chaim was that important, was that great. That's the concept behind it. We're going to end with one story over here. We have a lot of, if you want to look inside here, we've got a lot of other things that I didn't get to go through. But Rabbi Yitzchok Zilberstein brings a story about Rabbi Avram Abish, who is the Rav of the city of Frankfurt about 200 years ago. He once had to speak to a certain merchant in the city who was being Mechallel Shabbos. He found out that this guy was doing things on Shabbos and buying and selling things on Shabbos, and it wasn't working out. He called him in to come to the shul to speak to him. Called him to shul. The man refused to come. Not only that, the man refused to go to shul on Shabbos because he didn't want to see the Rav. He refused to go to shul during the week he didn't want to see the Rav. He was so scared of what the Rav was going to tell him, he didn't want to go. So now the Rav thought to himself and he said, what could I do? If I go to him, that's a pigam in the kavod of the Rav. I don't know why he felt that way, but apparently he thought that if he goes there, then other people are going to be expecting the same by them. The Rav comes to me, I don't have to go to the Rav. Maybe that's what he felt. He felt if a messenger is sent to go call him over again, he's going to ignore the message. If I send over a message to him through somebody else, maybe the message isn't going to be delivered in the best possible way. You know what I'm going to do? He calls over the number one, I guess this merchant had like certain people in the city that he did business with. He brought in one of the partners, one of the guys who bought all the stuff from this merchant, one of his guys, his customers, brought in his number one customer, told the customer, don't pay the merchant. Don't give him the money that you owe him. Okay? Wait, even if he threatens you, wait and make him take you to Beis Din in order for you to go through. So the guy did it. The guy listened to the Rav. He didn't give him the money. The guy threatened him, whatever. He said, I'm not giving him the threats. So he eventually had to take him to Beis Din. So what happened? The guy, the merchant, took this guy to Beis Din. Rav Avraham Abish was on the Beis Din. So he sat there and he obviously passed him like the guy. And he said, you get to pay the merchant. Go ahead and pay the merchant. But since he finally had the merchant in front of him, he told the merchant, you got to stop working on Shabbos. And the merchant turns to the Rav and says, listen, I know, and it's just the Yitzhara and a Taiva, and I'm trying to get over it, I know that, and I appreciate the Mutter, but I don't understand, why was this Mutter? Why was it Mutter to tell that guy not to pay me so that he could come to court so that you could give me Mutter? Why was that allowed? Why were you allowed to do that? Where's the Heter for such a thing? So Rav Mavish told him, I learned it from a Pasuk. Where do you learn it from? From Moshe Rabbeinu. This parsha, it says, Ki yela em dover. Said Moshe Rabbeinu, explain to the Israel what he does. When the people have a matter that they have to deal with, Boilai, they come to me, and I judge between one man and the other. And when they're standing in front of me, I take advantage of the situation. And the end of the pasuk is, Memela vehodati eschukei Elokim. I'm able to tell them over the laws of God. Since I can take advantage, I see them in front of me. They're right here anyway. I go ahead and I tell them exactly what it is. Said Rav Mavish, it's mutter to make a person come to court in order to tell them over the laws of Hashem, to take advantage of such a situation. That's how he darshened that pasuk to be able to say it. It's not direct, it's sort of an indirect drasha. Because the Zilberstein brings that down, that you can learn this from this pasuk to be able to get from somewhere else the proper way of doing things to be able to get them out there. Stop with this, guys. Have a good